Mr. Arthur Thompson, Rail 3. Now, Mr. Thompson, can you recall how was business transacted under the black market system?
Well, in the beginning, the shops were quite full with their goods, you know. They had the provisions, rice, oil, sugar, salt, and the basic necessities, you see. And we could buy these things. And what happened was gradually the provisions had dwindled down. There's hardly any provisions left in the shop, with the exception of oil, maybe. Oil, of course, was produced locally, coconut oil, and rice, the main necessities. Then we had starch like tapioca flour. We had sago seeds. We can use that. And then what else did they have? Coconut oil, of course. Then black market was a thing that was quite. But those days, yeah, that's right. Black market, as I say. The people did black market and acquired those who had bought stocks of goods like provisions and all that. And they could sell, you know, they sell like a tin of corned beef, it would be so many dollars, 10, 20, I don't know how many dollars a tin of corned beef, we had the money to pay. And if you wanted to buy extra rice, those who've been holding rice, they would sell that and acquire it in the black market. And you had to know the person, the context, before you can get these goods. And what we did is, if we hadn't the money, if we were not working at the time, we had to sort of sell off things that we had. The jewelries went first. My mother had some jewelry. We sold that, we had good money for it. And with that money, we, you know, sort of bought our things. And another thing too, I might as well mention this, the British currency notes fetched a very high value because many people wanted to buy British notes. And we had British notes. You could change them, say, for $10, you get a few hundred Japanese money, $200 Japanese dollars, something like that. That's what they estimated the value would be. Because they thought the Japanese currency will not have any value when the British come back. They were known as banana notes because of the imprint of the banana tree on these notes.
Yes. Besides the black market system, is there any other observations that you have made?
Well, rationing started then. As I told you, you issued cards. I think these were issued at the police station. We went to Juchat police station, whichever station nearby to your place. And this notification maybe came in the air and came in the papers. And they started printing the Shonan Sinbun. Shonan To, as Singapore was known then. It's called Shonan To. That was another name for Singapore in Japanese. And Shonan Shimbun, Shimbun in Japanese meaning paper. We used to buy the Japanese paper, they're very small, maybe 4 pages or so, 6 pages, not very many pages. And in that you have, you know, sometimes you get notices given out by the Japanese administrators asking everybody to get the ration cards and where to get them. And according to the number of people, the address, the household had so many people, and your ration according to that, you see. More people, of course you get more ration. And we had to go to the market to get our rations. Sometimes we went to the shop. Even bread was easy in the early days. We wanted bread as long as our wheat flour, ordinary bread we could get there. You know, the bread was made of wheat flour. Gradually there was no more bread to be bought. It was made of wheat flour. The bread that you could get later was made from jagung, that's corn flour. You know, corn? Or ragi, I think called ragi. Ragi in Malay, you know? I don't know what's the English word for it. And that bread was very, very hard. Those who remember it, they can tell you what. That bread, of course, you had to cut it up and fry it a little bit before you can eat it. It's hard, the square loaves, you know, about 6 inches long and about 2.5 or 3 inches high. That's the bread we had. The ration cards were issued about 6 months after the Japanese had taken Singapore, and each family had a ration card issued to each family. Of course, in that ration card, they mentioned the number of adults, the number of children, and accordingly, you got your rations. We could go to a shop with the ration card, and the man had to stamp it whenever he issues your ration. The shopman had to stamp it to say that it's been issued to you. You get maybe two bottles of oil or something and a few catties of rice and some tapioca flour, things like that, eh? Or starch flour. And then also at the same time, things were getting worse and worse. Rations were getting more scarce. The shops had closed down, that I noticed. Hardly anything in the shops, so we had to go to the market to get our rations later. And as time went on, and we had to go very early in the morning to the market. We had soap also given to us, and in order to get soap, we had to bring some ash, say 2 catties of ash, or according to the number of people, bring ash, and in the exchange for it, if you don't bring any ash, you won't get soap. Because that's the ash they need to make the soap, see? And we had some soap that was a help to us, plus tapioca. We couldn't get rice then at that time. That was about a year later, about a year, year and a half, as things were going on worse, I tell you. And tapioca, we wanted tapioca that we could get. We got 3 potatoes, and once in a while, this is not in the paper, not news, we get news from some neighbors, somebody from the shop would tell us, they just got some wild boar's meat, and that was really treasured, you know, and you have to rush to the market. Of course, you are in time to get it, you get it. Otherwise, you don't get any wild boar's meat. That's also, you have to use a card for that. Maybe from Malaysia, they put it down. See, wild boar's meat, that was, I think I can remember only about 3 or 4 times we had that wild boar's meat. Very scarce that was. Meat was, you never see any meat in those days. And the fish, well, I could get some fish from the fishermen. Without my eyes, without the ration card. Because we knew these Malay fishermen, the Koko Salam people, we knew them. When they brought in the fish, what I did now, since I had a lot of vegetables grown in my compound, I exchanged vegetables, tomatoes, you know, things like that, for fish. I gave it to the fisherman, and he gave me in exchange for that fish instead of money.
Yeah. When did this ration card implemented?
Well, 6 months after the fall, as I said.
Can you recall how long this system lasted?
Oh, it lasted right throughout the entire period of occupation. You see, the ration card came out earlier days. You had more frequent rations. As time went along, things were getting more difficult. Food was very short in Singapore, and there's no more rice coming into Singapore. So, you got rations maybe once a month. You know, on a longer period of waiting. Longer period. Yeah, as the things became worse, and I tell you what I observed. This is seeing this my own eyes. The family had to go down and get ourselves registered because we were enemy aliens, and we had to go down to. I remember it was a Chartered Bank building in Battery Road. That's where the Japanese administration officers looking after the enemy aliens in Singapore, mainly the Eurasians, and who were not interned, who were supposed to have been interned, while they stayed out, they were hiding, maybe like myself. And as we went along the bus along Geylang, Northbridge Road, we used to see people lying down along the 5 foot way, just beside the drains, you know, and they were still breathing, some of them dead, some of them not dead yet. And they're just living skeletons with the skin and bones. And the truck will come along, PUB or PWD lorries will come, PWD lorries will come along, and they examine the body, see if there's any life in him. If there's no life, the man is dead, they just carry the body, 2 or 3 chaps will carry and throw them inside the lorry. Just like throwing rubbish in there, into the PWD lorries for burial.
Yeah. Before I asked you, How you came to sign up as enemy aliens? I'd like to ask you about the time frame, you know, which you witness all these changes occur. For example, you mentioned about the modes of transportation, the difference in administration, the black market system, and the registration of cars.
Yeah, there were a few buses running in those days. They managed to get oil, a little bit of oil to run the buses. And those buses were full. We had a queue up for the buses. The terminus would be in Geylang Serai. And it goes right down straight to Tanjung Pagar. That's the main road, trunk road, no? Buses running up and down. And a few cars, taxis that could get the oil, they could still run around for the first 6, 7, 8, 10 months, maybe a year. But after 1 year, 1.5 years, things became very bad. When there was no oil, oil was very short, they used charcoal. They used coal. And if you crank up the engine, you know, make a lot of noise, they removed the seats in the taxi. This upholstery was removed.
Now, I'm sorry to interrupt, yeah, because you did mention about all this before.
I did mention, yeah.
But I'd like to know about which period of the Japanese occupation did this occur?
This was about 2 years later. 2 years, I think. Two and a half years later it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 2.5 years. Yes, about the changes, you want to know how these things happen, the sequence. Well, I was, as I told you, I was in hiding and didn't come out of the house to go. If I did come out the house after, say, 3 months, between 3 to 6 months, I went around, whether it's the seaside or just in the neighborhood, that's all, the shops. Then the, after that, there was some taxis, few cars moving. The cars were all taken by the Japanese. That's one thing I must inform, tell you this. And it's interesting to know that these cars were painted brown color, military color. And the officers, of course, took the best cars. The ordinary captains and lower ranks, they had a smaller car. They had a blue flag flying from the front of the car. That was the captain's name. And what I understand is another big shot, higher rank officer, he had a little better car. And his car had a red flag, remember that. And the general, of course, had the biggest car. They had good cars, maybe Mercedes or something like that. And that car had a yellow flag. Then you know that's the general that's passing on the road. And the soldiers, of course, the only soldiers, they had trucks, had Japanese trucks and lorries going around, moving, carrying, transporting soldiers about the place. And as time went along, then as I mentioned about these ration cars coming out, and that was in force right throughout the period in the occupation. And a few buses on the road. The buses did not run along East Coast Road. The buses ran along the main trunk route. And you had to go down to Changi, you know, Geylang Serai, get a bus from there, and that bus goes straight to Tanjung Pagar, round Tanjung Pagar, and back again. That's the main trunk road where all buses and cars and all that pass. Because the Japanese had taken up all the houses and, you know, made a line, drawn line across East Coast right up to the seaside, and all Mountbatten Road was closed. Mountbatten Road was known as Grove Road in those days. It was named Mountbatten after Earl Mountbatten. General Mountbatten was Southeast Asia, not commanding officer, who had taken Singapore, named after him. And Tanjung Katong Road was blocked. You couldn't go to Tanjung Katong Road. So Joo Chiat Road was all right. You can go through it. Sorry. And when we had occasion to go to town, that was about 2 years, 2.5 years later, when we were made enemy aliens, we had to go to, Chartered Bank Chambers. That was in Battery Road. And as we passed along North Beach Road, Geylang, passing the bus, we were seeing the bus and seen these people starving.
Yes, you did mention that it was only after 2.5 years that you signed up as enemy alien. But before that, you were in hiding for 3 months when the Japanese landed. Now, I'm interested to know, between the period up to when you signed up for registration, what were you doing?
Well, we couldn't do anything much, my brother and myself. There were jobs offered by the Japs, and my mother was afraid that if we went out to work, we might get lost, maybe taken as forced labor. They were fond of taking laborers, forced labor, maybe taking them to Malaysia, some they brought them to Indonesia, and some Indonesians were brought to Singapore, Japanese, you know, Japanese laborers. And the mother said, no, we won't go out of the house, we stay. And what I did to keep myself going was I had some land, I planted vegetables, planted my own tapioca, tomatoes and things like that. You see, as I told you just now. And we carried on living that way and kept on selling We had some very good material, cloth material, the tablecloths and things we sold at a very good price. That, as I said, black market, huh? You could sell it to people who had the money, who made money, these Chinese businessmen, they would buy and pay a very good price for it, of course, in Japanese money. That tide is over. We could buy our rations then, whatever rations we could buy then. And then, as I've said, gradually, as it went along, say about a year later, year and a half, there were our own people, Eurasians here, who were collaborators with the Japanese, and that was a known fact. And they, you know, prepared a kind of report, like for Japanese, saying that there were some Eurasians who were still staying, living out in Singapore, and who they were, they seemed to know. So they came to visit us, and they told us we had to register. That's how we know. That's how we knew about this, and when we had to go. And he wanted my brothers, you know, myself, to go to learn Japanese. Why do we go and learn Japanese? So we said, no, we don't want to learn Japanese. Our, you know, mother didn't want us to go out, you see. Then we took the bus and we went down to this building, Chartered Bank, when they got in Battery Road. There, of course, we signed a document and we were given a piece of a kind of a badge you used. There was a star, I remember, on that badge. And there was some Japanese characters written the top, size upon. That means to say you're an enemy alien, you're on parole. And there was some rules we were given to see, to look through before we signed. And I remember reading this part of it. We cannot poison the reservoir, not to cut telephone wires, and you had to be indoors by 6 o'clock. From 6 o'clock to next 6 o'clock the next following morning, we couldn't go out. We had to be at home. You stay indoors, you know. Curfew for us. If we did go out, and within that period, we did anything, we contravene any of those rules, we'll be punished. And talking about punishment, yes, I'll tell you something about the occupation. We, none of the people that were, you know, out in Singapore, and dared speak evil against the Japanese, say anything bad about them, because you never know who was a collaborator. There were a lot of spies. And the day when carried back the news to the Japanese authorities, you were taken. Sometimes they don't question you. And even though you might be an innocent person, because he bore a grudge on you, and you'll be taken to YMCA as the famous torture house.
Yes, can you remember what you saw on that day at the registration center?
Well, there was a Japanese officer, some of our local people, and he wanted us to swear. Swear, put your hand in the Bible, you see. My mother, myself, no, signed it and swear. But there was one consolation. this is a bit of a superstition. My mother believed, my father believed, father being American. I saw the date was the 23rd. I remember very well, 23rd. When I saw 23rd, and I whispered my mother, I said, see the date. We didn't say anything more, you see. My mother knew, my brother knew. Because anything that's being done on the 23rd, a sign or, will never succeed, you know. You never go through with it.
Yes, can you remember seeing any other kinds of nationalities there?
Well, when you say enemy aliens, means either your father could have been a soldier, a volunteer, then you are an enemy. That's one way they say. And if your father's American, or your father's Dutch, or your father's British, you understand? Or some people holding British passports. As I tell you, I'm going to tell you this now. When I was interned, I think if not mistaken, there were 42 different nationalities in camp. That's what I was told. Because I've seen Chinese in camp too, the Chinese man, Mr. Tan, because he's a British subject. He might have married a European, maybe. There was a very black man there, Negro. He was a British subject. You understand? And, all nationalities there in camp. There were French, there were Dutch, there were Canadians, there were Americans.
No, coming back to the registration center again, can you remember how many people were there signing up?
No, not so many people. Not so many people.
Can you remember what did you do after the registration?
Well, after the registration, we went home, all of us, mother, myself, brother, and then carried on as usual, as I told you. I was growing, planting my own vegetables, And we had to live, you know, very carefully. Whatever rations we had, we didn't have much. We lived on bubu rice, you know. So, and we had a Japanese fellow. I don't know his name. Must have been Hiroshi or something. His name is Hiroshi. I remember now. I remember Hiroshi. He was a stout Japanese chap, a civilian, and I understood him to be one of these Japanese secret police or something like that. He'd come and talk to us, you know, chit-chat, and we were quite friendly. We offered him a drink. Sometimes he'll ask me to pull a tapioca out and boil tapioca for him to eat, and he'll join in, put some sugar and heat. And my mother always advises us to be very careful what you say. And we never said anything out of the way. We just joked with him and talked about food or talked about our gardening and showed him all the seeds. I got different plants, how they grow. We spoke in general, obviously, no? Never mentioned about the war, never said anything about my father, what he did and things like that.
Yes. Do you know what's the purpose of the Japanese asking people to sign up as enemy aliens?
Well, what I can see of it was the war was coming to an end. That was a thing we knew, and they wanted to identify us in case of an emergency. If any trouble starts, they can help, you know, round us up easily. They know where we're all located, and we'll be indoors then. You see, we're not supposed to go out, as I told you, after certain time, certain hours.
How long were you living as an enemy aliens?
Now, after we had this badge, you know, as I told you, being enemy aliens, classified as enemy aliens, father being American, maybe 6 months. Then after 3 years, we were rounded up, all of us, and brought to camp.
When you say after 3 years, which point?
Two and a half years, about 2.5 years where we had this, when we were supposed to register as enemy aliens, we did that. We were given the badge and restricted to living in a home after late hours. That was only for about 6 months.
So what happened after that?
After that, we were interned.
Why were you interned?
Well, why we were interned was this is very clear. They didn't tell us this, but we knew it also from other sources, that the war was coming to an end. War was coming closer to Singapore. They were fighting in Burma, we understood at that time.
Mm-hmm.
There was war in Burma and Philippines as well, the last 6 months.
How did you become an intern?
Well, we were caught by surprise, and what happened was a lorry came. It was about 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, I think. And one of the officers came out, you know. He told us he had to be interned. I take all your things. Not everything, but just your clothes and your things. Just your clothes only and leave everything else behind. So we thought we had to bring in a bed. We managed to bring in our beds anyway. That we were lucky. But not everybody had a chance of taking their bed in, you know. They allowed us to take the bed in. Not too many things. Then we went along and pitched another family, and we knew these people also. You know, these people knew my mother, no? And this Eurasian family, we knew them. Then we went along again, another place like somewhere else, in Geylang or somewhere, I don't know. And we met another family, and they also got up the lorry. And they drove straight to camp. And the camp was in Sime Road. You know Sime Road? Sime Road is off Adam Road, off Bukit Timah Road. That was a camp, internment camp.
Yes. Did the rest of the family go along too?
Yeah, all of us. A whole lot. My mother, brother, myself.
Yes. Coming back to the point in which the Japanese came for all of you, what were your reactions then?
Well, we were sort of worried, like, you know. We were taken by surprise, of course, and we were worried. Now, we thought, I suppose, that things are coming. Things are getting very bad. We knew that things were getting very bad.
Mm-hmm.
We knew, and my mother also says, look at it for the best. Maybe it's for the best. that we should be interned there and be with all the other internees rather than stay out. Maybe we might be safer inside. Who knows? You know, better off inside.
Yes, at that point of time, have you any clues what to expect?
We did not think, we didn't know, you see, what camp life was like until we got in. And they asked the other Europeans who were interned, and we saw people whom we knew. Like the European fellow man who was staying opposite, the Scotsman staying opposite my house, I saw him. And I saw other people whom we knew too, we spoke to them.
Yes, at the camp, I'm sorry about that, can you describe more about the camp then, at Symes Road?
Yes, Symes Road, yeah. Yes, Symes Road camp, they had a lot of huts. They built the huts for us ready for the US Eurasians. They were long attap huts, you know. And we had doors along, and we had a concrete floor. That's all, little drainage around side. And I saw a lot of vegetables being planted. The internees had to live on whatever they grow there. No vegetables came up, vegetables or fruits came up from outside, no? They planted a lot of tapioca and a lot of other vegetables like kangkong and all that, sweet potatoes. And the rice was very, very scarce. We ate bubo rice, you know. Morning early, we had kanji. And then every hut, you had a hut representative. One man was supposed to be the hut representative, and he had a quartermaster. Quartermaster was the man who looked after the food. He had dished out the food to all the internees, and we had numbers given to us. We had little discs tied around our waist, you know, numbers, little plates made in camp. And according to a number, we had our rations, numbers called 1, 2, 3, 4. And for seconds up, you know, there's a number on the board, the last man might have been 21, the last ration. Well, start from 22 onwards, and maybe 9 followers get the seconds, you know, then extra ration, up to 29. Then next ration comes, maybe from 30 onwards. You're lucky you get seconds, they call it seconds. And that's all you get. And the tea, of course, is hot water with a lot of leaves in it. I don't know, that's supposed to be tea. No sugar, nothing, that's so plain. And the food was terrible. It was terrible.